3 of the 6 days would be gone. If the Germans waited on the Angerrab for Rennenkampf to come against them, they might be caught between both armies at once. Just at this moment, word was received from the 20th Corps that Samsonov's army had that morning crossed the frontier. The second claw of the pincer was advancing. The Germans must either fight Rennenkampf at once, giving up their prepared position on the Angerrab, or disengage and turn against Samsonov. Prittwitz and his staff decided on the former and told François to attack next morning, August 20. The only difficulty was that the other 2.5 corps, dutifully waiting on the Angerrab, could not be activated in time to catch up with him. Before dawn, von François's heavy artillery opened fire, taking the Russians by surprise. The shelling continued for half an hour. At 4 a.m. his infantry moved forward over the stubbled fields in the uncertain dark until they came within rifle distance of the Russian lines. As morning broke, combat spread like a licking fire over the front. Russian field batteries poured shells on the advancing grey lines and saw the white road ahead suddenly turn grey with the bodies of the fallen. A second wave of grey charged, coming nearer. The Russians could make out the spiked helmets. Their batteries fired again and the wave went down and another came. The Russian guns, supplied with ammunition at a rate of 244 rounds per day, were now firing at a rate of 440 per day. An airplane with black crosses flew over and bombed their artillery positions. The grey waves kept on coming. They were within 500 yards when the Russian guns stuttered and fell silent. Their ammunition was used up. François's two divisions cut up the Russian 28th Division, inflicting a casualty rate of 60%, virtual annihilation. François's cavalry, with 3 batteries of horse artillery, made a wide sweep around the open Russian end, unopposed by the Russian cavalry, which, having no artillery, took itself off, permitting the Germans to fall upon the Russian transport in the rear. These were the fortunes of the corps on Rennenkampf's extreme right. On his centre and left, matters went very differently. Here the Russians, warned by the sound of François's pre-dawn cannon, were ready for the attack, which came piecemeal over a front 35 miles wide. In the centre, the German 17th Corps did not reach the front until 8 a.m., 4 hours behind François, and on the German right, the 1st Reserve Corps did not arrive till noon. The 17th was commanded by General August von Mackensen, another of the group of generals who'd fought in 1870 and were now 65 or over. The 1st Reserve was commanded by General Otto von Below. They had been behind the Angerrab on the evening of the 19th when they received the unexpected order to join François in an offensive beyond Gumbinnen next morning. Hurriedly assembling his units, Mackensen crossed the river during the night to become entangled on the other side among refugees, wagons and livestock on the roads. By the time they sorted themselves out and advanced far enough to make contact with the enemy, they'd lost the advantage of surprise and the Russians opened fire first. The effect of shelling by heavy guns is devastating, whoever is on the receiving end, and in this, one of the rare cases of 1914, the receivers were Germans. The infantry was pinned to the ground, lying face down, not daring to raise their heads. Ammunition wagons were blown up, horses were galloping riderless. By afternoon, Mackensen's 35th Division broke under the fire. A company threw away its arms and ran. Another caught the panic, then a whole regiment, then those on either side of it. Soon the roads and fields were covered with battalions streaming to the rear. Staff and divisional officers and Mackensen himself tore across the front in motors, attempting to stem the rout, which continued for 15 miles before it could be halted. On Mackensen's right, von Below's 1st Reserve Corps could give no help because it had started even later, and by the time it reached its appointed sector at Goldap on the edge of Romington Forest, was at once heavily engaged by the Russians. The rout of Mackensen's corps in the centre uncovered von Below's left flank, forcing him too to retire, both in order to cover Mackensen's retreat and to protect himself. On von Below's right, the 3rd Reserve Division, commanded by General von Morgan, which had started from the Angerrab last of all, did not arrive until evening when all was over, and saw no action. Although the Germans made good their retreat, and the Russians had suffered severely against François, The Battle of Gumbinnen was on the whole a Russian victory. Prittwitz saw his whole campaign undone. A vigorous Russian pursuit through the broken German centre could smash through the Insterburg Gap, splitting the Eighth Army and pushing François's corps in the north into refuge within the Königsberg fortified zone, which OHL had expressly warned must not be allowed to happen. To save the Eighth Army and hold it together, Prittwitz saw retreat to the Vistula as the only solution. Moltke's last words to him had been, "Keep the army intact. Don't be driven from the Vistula, but in case of extreme need, abandon the region east of the Vistula." Prittwitz felt the extreme need was now, especially after a talk over the telephone with Mackensen, who vividly described the panic of his troops. At 6 o'clock that evening, August 20, he called François and told him that in spite of success on his sector, the army must retreat to the Vistula. Thunderstruck, François protested violently, urged reasons for Prittwitz to reconsider, contended that because of their own losses the Russians could not mount an energetic pursuit, besought him to change his mind. He hung up with an impression that Prittwitz was not entirely adamant and had agreed to think it over. At headquarters, through a chaos of excited comings and goings and conflicting reports, an astonishing condition began clearly to emerge. There was no pursuit. At Russian headquarters, Rennenkampf had given the order to pursue between 3 and 4 o'clock that afternoon, but owing to reports of heavy German artillery fire covering Mackensen's retreat, had cancelled the order at 4:30. Uncertain of the extent of the German rout in the centre, he waited. An exhausted staff officer who asked his permission to go to bed was told he might lie down but not undress. He slept for an hour and was wakened by Rennenkampf, who stood by his bed smiling and said, "You can take off your clothes now. The Germans are retiring." Much has been made of this remark by the military historians who swarm over a battle after it is over, especially by Hoffmann, who reports it with malicious glee in a rather distorted version. They point out with some truth that when an enemy is retiring is the time to pursue, not to go to bed. Because of the momentous results of the Battle of Tannenberg, of which Gumbinnen was a preliminary, the episode of Rennenkampf's halt has raised clouds of fevered explanations and accusations, not omitting references to his German ancestry and the explicit charge that he was a traitor. The more probable explanation was offered 100 years before the event by Clausewitz. "The whole weight of all that is sensuous in an army," he wrote in discussing the problem of pursuit, "presses for rest and refreshment. It requires exceptional vigour on the part of a commander to see and feel beyond the present moment and to act at once to attain those results which at the time seemed to be the mere embellishments of victory, the luxury of triumph." Whether or not Rennenkampf perceived those ultimate results, the fact was that he could not, or felt he could not, fling himself after the fleeing enemy to pluck the final victory. His supply lines were functioning weakly. To advance further beyond his railhead would be to outrun them altogether. He would be lengthening his lines in hostile territory, while the Germans, falling back toward their base, were shortening theirs. He could not use the German railways without capturing their rolling stock, and he had no railroad gangs to alter the gauge. His transport was in chaos after the German cavalry attack. His right-wing cavalry had performed miserably. He lost most of a division. He stayed where he was. The evening was hot. Colonel Hoffmann was standing outside the house in which German headquarters was located, debating the battle and the prospects for tomorrow with his immediate superior, Major General Grönert, with whom he expected to govern the weaker wills of Prittwitz and Waldersee. Just then a message was brought to them. It was from General Scholz of the 20th Corps, reporting that the southern Russian army was now across the frontier with 4 or 5 corps and advancing over a front 50 to 60 miles wide. Hoffmann, in that disturbing way he had which no one quite knew whether to take seriously, suggested suppressing the report in order to keep it from Prittwitz and Waldersee, who in his judgment had for the moment lost command of their nerves. No other phrase in Memoirs of the War attains the universality of "he lost control of his nerves," usually applied to a colleague. In this instance it was doubtless justified. Hoffman's brief plot was in vain, however, for at that moment Prittwitz and Woldersee came out of the house, wearing expressions showing that they too had received the report. Prittwitz called them all indoors and said, "Gentlemen, if we continue the battle against the Vilna army, the Warsaw army will advance on our rear and cut us off from the Vistula. We must break off the fight against the Vilna army and retire behind the Vistula." He was no longer talking of retreat to, but behind the Vistula. Hoffmann and Grunert instantly disputed the necessity, claiming they could finish off battle with the Vilna army in 2 or 3 days, and still be in time to face the danger from the south, and until then Scholz's corps could manage for themselves. Prittwitz harshly cut them off. It was up to him and Woldersee to make the decision. He insisted that the threat of the southern Russian army was too great. Hoffmann must make the necessary arrangements for retreat behind the Vistula. Hoffmann pointed out that the left wing of the southern army was already nearer to the Vistula than the Germans were, and demonstrating with a compass showed that the retreat had become impossible. He asked to be instructed how to carry it out. Prittwitz abruptly dismissed him and everyone in the room and telephoned to OHL at Koblenz, announcing his intention to retreat to the Vistula if not behind it. He added that its waters in the summer heat were at low ebb, and he was doubtful if he could even hold the river without reinforcements. Moltke was aghast. This was the result of leaving that fat idiot in command of the Eighth Army, and of his own ill-considered last words to him. To yield East Prussia would be to suffer a tremendous moral defeat, and lose the most valuable grain and dairy region as well. Worse, if the Russians crossed the Vistula, they would threaten not only Berlin, but the Austrian flank and even Vienna. Reinforcements? Where could he get reinforcements except from the Western Front, where every last battalion was engaged? To withdraw troops from the Western Front now could mean loss of the campaign against France. Moltke was too shocked, or too distant from the scene, to think to issue a counter-order. For the moment, he contented himself with ordering his staff to find out the facts in direct conversation with François, Mackensen, and the other corps commanders. Meanwhile, at Eighth Army headquarters, Hoffmann and Grunert were trying to persuade Woldersee that retreat was not the only course, was indeed an impossible course. Hoffmann now proposed a maneuver by which the Eighth Army, taking advantage of its interior lines and the use of railways, could so dispose itself as to meet the threat of both Russian armies, and if things developed as he thought they would, be in a position to throw all its weight against one of them. He proposed, if Rennenkampf's army still did not pursue next day, and he did not think it would, to disengage François's First Corps and bring it the long way round by rail to reinforce Scholz's 20th Corps on the southern front. François would take up a position on Scholz's right, opposite Samsonov's left wing, which being nearest to the Vistula was the most threatening. General von Morgan's division, which had not been in action at Gumbinnen, would also be sent to Scholz's support by a different set of railway lines. The movement of troops, with all their stores, equipment, horses, guns and munitions, the assembling of trains, the boarding at stations mobbed by refugees, the switching of trains from one line to another, would be a complex matter. But Hoffmann was sure the German railroad system, on which so much brain power had been expended, would be equal to it. While this movement was underway, the retreat of Mackensen's and von Bellow's corps would be directed toward the south for another 2 days' march, so that when successfully disengaged they would be some 30 miles nearer the southern front. From here, if all went well, they would march across the short inner distance to take up a position on Scholz's left, which they should reach not long after François reached his right. Thus the whole army of 4.5 corps would be in place to engage the enemy's southern army. The cavalry and Königsberg reserves would be left as a screen in front of Rennenkampf's army. The success of this manoeuvre depended entirely upon a single condition, that Rennenkampf would not move. Hoffmann believed he would remain stationary for another day or more, to rest and refit and make good his supply lines. His confidence was based not on any mysterious betrayal or other sinister or supernatural intelligence, but simply on his belief that Rennenkampf had come to a halt from natural causes. In any event, Mackensen's and von Bellow's corps would not change fronts for another 2 or 3 days. By that time there should be some sign, with the help of further intercepted codes, of Rennenkampf's intentions. Such was Hoffmann's argument, and he persuaded von Woldersee. Somehow, sometime that night, Woldersee either persuaded Prittwitz or allowed Hoffmann to prepare the necessary orders without Prittwitz's approval. The record is not clear. As the staff did not know that Prittwitz had in the meantime told OHL of his intention to retreat to the Vistula, no one had bothered to inform the Supreme Command that the idea of retreat had been given up. Next morning, two of Moltke's staff, after battling the frustrations of the field telephone for some hours, succeeded in talking individually with each corps commander in the East, from whom they gathered that matters were serious but retreat too rash a solution. As Prittwitz seemed committed to retreat, Moltke decided to replace him. While he was talking it over with his deputy von Stein, Colonel Hoffmann was enjoying the delightful sensation of being right, so far. Reconnaissance showed Rennenkampf's army quiescent. They are not pursuing us at all. Orders were at once issued for the movement of François's First Corps to the south. François, according to his own account, was overcome with emotion and wept when he left Gumbinnen that afternoon. Prittwitz had apparently approved and immediately regretted it. That evening he called OHL again and told von Stein and Moltke that the proposal of his staff to advance against the Warsaw army was impossible, too daring. In reply to a question, he said he could not even guarantee to hold the Vistula with his handful of men. He must have reinforcements. That sealed his dismissal. With the Eastern Front in danger of collapse, someone bold, strong, and decisive was needed at once to take over the command. How a commander will meet the crises of real war is never certain in advance, but OHL was fortunate in knowing of a staff officer who only a week ago had proved himself in action, Ludendorff, the hero of Liège. He would do for chief of staff of the Eighth Army. In the German system of command, exercised through a pair, the chief of staff was as important as the commanding officer, and sometimes, depending on capacity and temperament, more so. Ludendorff was at that moment with von Bülow's Second Army on the outskirts of Namur, where, following his success at Liège, he was directing the storming of Belgium's second great fortress. He was on the doorstep of France at a crucial moment, but the need of the Eastern Front was drastic. Moltke and von Stein agreed he must be called. A staff captain was instantly dispatched by motor car with a letter which reached General Ludendorff at 9 next morning, August 22. "You may be able to save the situation in the East," wrote von Stein. "I know no other man in whom I have such absolute trust." He apologized for drawing Ludendorff away from the threshold of a decisive action which, please God, will be conclusive, but the sacrifice was imperative. "Of course you will not be held responsible for what has already happened in the East, but with your energy you can prevent the worst from happening." Ludendorff left within 15 minutes in the staff captain's car. 10 miles from Namur, he drove through Wavre, which only the day before, when I passed through it, had been a peaceful town. Now it was in flames. Here also the populace fired on our troops. At 6 that evening, Ludendorff arrived at Koblenz. Within 3 hours, he was briefed on the situation in the East, was received by Moltke, who was looking tired, and by the Kaiser, who was very calm, but deeply affected by the invasion of East Prussia. Ludendorff issued certain orders to the Eighth Army and departed at 9 p.m. by special train for the Eastern Front. The orders he issued, besides directing Hoffmann and Grunert to meet him at Marienburg, were for François's corps to be sent by train to support Schultz's 20th Corps on the southern front. Mackensen's and von Bellow's two corps were to complete their disengagement and rest and refit through August 23. These were the same as Hoffmann's orders, thus realizing the ideal of the German War College, in which all students, given the problem, come up with the identical solution. It is also possible that Ludendorff saw a telegraphed copy of Hoffmann's orders. During the drive through Belgium, Ludendorff was told by the staff captain that as new commander of the Eighth Army, OHL had selected a retired general, but it was not yet known whether he would accept the post. His name was Paul von Benneckendorff und Hindenburg. Ludendorff did not know him. Before leaving Koblenz later that night, he learned that General von Hindenburg had been located, had accepted the post, and would board the train at Hanover next morning at 4 a.m. After deciding on a chief of staff, OHL had turned to the problem of finding a commanding officer. Ludendorff, everybody felt, was certainly a man of undeniable ability, but to complete the pair, it would be well to have a regular von. The names of various retired corps commanders were considered. Von Stein remembered a letter he had received from a former comrade on the outbreak of war, saying, "Don't forget me if, as things develop, a commanding officer is needed anywhere," and promising that the writer was still robust. Just the man. He came from an old Junker family, established in Prussia for centuries. He'd served on the general staff under Schlieffen and risen through all the proper steps to become a corps chief of staff and subsequently a corps commander, before retiring at 65 in 1911. He would be 68 in 2 months, but he was no older than Kluck, Bülow and Hausen, the three generals of the right wing. What was wanted in the East, especially after Prittwitz's panic, was a man of no nerves, and Hindenburg, throughout a solid, dependable career, had been known for his imperturbability. Moltke approved, the Kaiser gave his consent. A telegram was dispatched to the retired general. Hindenburg was at home in Hanover when, at 3 p.m., he received a telegram asking if he would accept immediate employment. He replied, "I am ready." A second telegram instructed him to leave for the East at once to take command of the Eighth Army. OHL did not bother to invite him to Koblenz for talks. He was instructed to board the train at Hanover and informed that his chief of staff would be General Ludendorff, who would meet him on the train en route. Hindenburg had just time to be fitted for one of the new field grey uniforms before departing, much to his embarrassment, in the old blue uniform of a Prussian general. When the recall of Prittwitz was made public a few days later, the invaluable diarist Princess Blücher noted, "A General Hindenburg, quite an old man, has taken his place." Newspaper editors hurriedly scraped together material about the new commander, which was difficult to find since he appeared under Beneckendorff in the army list. They were gratified to discover that he had fought at Sedan, where he received the Iron Cross Second Class, and was also a veteran of the earlier war against Austria in 1866. His Beneckendorff ancestors were among the Teutonic Knights who had settled East Prussia. The name Hindenburg was a product of marriage connections in the 18th century. He was a native of Posen in West Prussia, and early in his career, a staff officer to the First Corps at Königsberg, had studied the military problems of the Missourian Lake District, a fact that was soon to become the germ of the legend that depicted Hindenburg planning the Battle of Tannenberg 30 years in advance. He'd been brought up on his grandparents' estate in Neudeck in West Prussia, and remembered having had talks as a boy with an old gardener who had once worked 2 weeks for Frederick the Great. He was waiting at the station in Hanover when the train drew in at 4 in the morning. General Ludendorff, whom he had never met, stepped briskly to the platform to report himself. On the way east, he explained the situation and the orders he had already issued. Hindenburg listened and approved. So was born, on the way to the battle that was to make them famous, the combination of the marriage expressed in the mystic monogram HL that was to rule Imperial Germany until the end. When sometime later he was made a field marshal, Hindenburg earned the nickname Marshal Was sagst du? Because of his habit, whenever asked for an opinion, of turning to Ludendorff and asking, "Was sagst du? What do you say?" Characteristically, the first person OHL sought to inform of the change in the Eighth Army command was the Director of Railways on the Eastern Front, Major General Kersten. On the afternoon of August 22, even before the special train had started on its way, this officer came into Hoffmann's office wearing a very startled expression and showed him a telegram announcing the arrival next day at Marienburg of an extra train bringing a new commander and new chief of staff. That was how Prittwitz and Woldersee learned of their dismissal. An hour later, Prittwitz received a personal telegram placing him and Woldersee on the unattached list. "He took leave of us," says Hoffmann, "without a single word of complaint of this treatment." Ludendorff's methods were no more tactful. Although he knew Hoffmann well, having lived in the same house with him in Berlin for 4 years, when both were serving on the general staff, he nevertheless telegraphed his orders to each of the corps commanders individually, instead of through the 8th Army staff. This was not necessarily a deliberate effort to be offensive. It was normal for general staff officers to be offensive. Hoffmann and Grunert promptly felt insulted. The reception they tendered the new commanders at Marienburg was, says Ludendorff, anything but cheerful. The critical question on which the fate of the campaign hung now had to be faced. Should Mackensen's and von Bellow's corps remain where they were for defence against a further advance by Rennenkampf, or should they be moved south in accordance with Hoffmann's plan to oppose Samsonov's right wing? There was no hope of defeating Samsonov's army except by the whole of the 8th Army. François's corps, on that day, August 23, was finishing the intricate process of entrainment at 5 different stations between Insterburg and Königsberg, and was now en route to the southern front. It would take another 2 days of switchings and sidings and equally intricate detrainment before it would be in position to fight. Von Morgan's division was also on its way by a different line. Mackensen's and von Bellow's corps were halted for the day. Cavalry reconnaissance reported continued passivity on the part of Rennenkampf's army. He was only separated from Mackensen and von Bellow by some 30 to 40 miles, and if they were moved south against the other Russian army, he could still, if he moved, follow and fall upon their rear. Hoffmann wanted Mackensen and von Bellow to start on their way at once. Ludendorff, barely 36 hours out of Namur, and newly arrived in a situation in which a decision either way might be fatal, and for which he would be responsible, was uncertain. Hindenburg, barely 24 hours out of retirement, was relying on Ludendorff. On the Russian side, the task of timing the pincers to close simultaneously upon the enemy tormented the higher command. So many and various, intractable and obvious were the stumbling blocks, that the military chiefs were ridden with pessimism from the start. General Jilinski, commander of the Northwest Front, whose function was to coordinate the movements of Rennenkampf's and Samsonov's armies, could think of no better way to perform it than by continued instructions to hurry. As Rennenkampf had started first and gone into action first, Jilinski addressed all his hurry-up orders to Samsonov. At the same time, Jilinski himself was on the receiving end of a chain of ever more urgent pleas from the French. To relieve the pressure upon them in the West, the French instructed their ambassador to insist upon the necessity of the Russian armies prosecuting their offensive à outrance toward Berlin. From Joffre to Paris, from Paris to St. Petersburg, from St. Petersburg to Stavka, Russian general headquarters at Baranovichi, from Stavka to Jilinski, the demands passed, and Jilinski passed them all on to General Samsonov, struggling forward foot by foot through sand. Since commanding a cavalry division in the Russo-Japanese War, this simple and kindly man, as the British liaison officer with the Second Army called him, had had no experience fitting him to command an army of 13 divisions. He was working through a staff and divisional commanders unfamiliar to him. Because the Russian army was not organized on a regional basis, the newly reported reservists, numbering in some cases up to 2/3 of a regiment, were complete strangers to their NCOs and officers. The shortage of officers and the low, often non-existent level of literacy among the men did not ease the process of communicating orders down the line. Almost the worst confusion was in the Signal Corps. At the telegraph office in Warsaw, a staff officer discovered to his horror a pile of telegrams addressed to the Second Army lying unopened and unforwarded because no communication had been established with field headquarters. The officer gathered them up and delivered them by car. Corps headquarters had only enough wire to connect with the divisional commands, but not enough to connect with army headquarters or with neighboring corps, hence the resort to wireless. Because of the insistence on haste, 4 days had been cut out of the period of concentration, leaving the organization of the rear services incomplete. One corps had to dole out its shells to another, whose supply train had not come up, thus upsetting its own calculations. Bakery wagons were missing. To enable an army to live off the country in hostile territory, Requisitioning parties were required to be sent ahead under cavalry escort, but no arrangements for this had been made. Single horsepower proved inadequate to pull wagons and gun carriages over the sandy roads. In some places, the horses had to be unharnessed from half the wagons, hitched up in double harness to the other half, moved forward a certain distance, unhitched, brought back, harnessed up to the stranded wagons, and the process began all over again. "Hurry up the advance of the Second Army and hasten your operations as energetically as possible," Jelinski wired on August 19. "The delay in the advance of the Second Army is putting the First Army in a difficult position." This was not true. Samsonov, on the 19th, was crossing the frontier on schedule, but Jelinski was so sure it was going to be true that he was anticipating. "Advancing according to timetable, without halting, covering marches of more than 12 miles over sand, I cannot go more quickly," Samsonov replied. He reported that his men were on the move for 10 or 12 hours a day without halts. "I must have immediate and decisive operations," Jelinski telegraphed 3 days later. "Great weariness of his men made greater speed impossible," Samsonov answered. "The country is devastated. The horses have long been without oats. There is no bread." On that day, Samsonov's 25th Corps, commanded by General Martos, came up against the German 20th Corps of General Scholz. Combat was opened. The Germans, not yet reinforced, retreated. About 10 miles inside the frontier, General Martos captured Soldau and Niedenberg, which until a few hours before had been General Scholz's headquarters. When Cossack patrols entering Niedenberg reported German civilians firing on them from the windows, General Martos ordered a bombardment of the town which destroyed most of the main square. A small, grey man, he personally felt uncomfortable that night when he found himself billeted in a house whose German owners had departed, leaving behind their family photographs staring at him from the mantelpiece. It was the mayor's house, and General Martos ate a dinner prepared for the mayor and served by his maid. On August 23, the day Ludendorff and Hindenburg arrived in the east, the Russian 6th and 13th Corps, on the right of General Martos, captured more villages. General Scholz, still alone except for some support from the Vistula garrison behind him, backed up a little farther. Ignoring Rennenkampf's inactivity in the north, Jelinski continued to rain orders on Samsonov. The Germans on his front were hastily retreating, he told Samsonov, leaving only insignificant forces facing you. You are therefore to execute a most energetic offensive. You are to attack and intercept the enemy retiring before General Rennenkampf's army in order to cut off his retreat from the Vistula. This was, of course, the original design, but it was predicated on Rennenkampf's holding the Germans occupied in the north. In fact, on that date, Rennenkampf was no longer in contact with the enemy. He began to advance again on August 23, but in the wrong direction. Instead of moving crabwise to the south to link up with Samsonov in front of the lakes, he moved straight west to mask Königsberg, fearful that François would attack his flank if he turned south. Although it was a movement with no relevance at all to the original design, Jelinski did nothing to alter it. Operating like Rennenkampf in a complete fog as to the German movements, he assumed they were doing what the Russians had planned on their doing, retreating to the Vistula. Accordingly, he continued to push Samsonov forward. On the evening of August 23, General Martos's corps, encouraged by the feel of the enemy falling back, moved on from Niedenberg and reached positions within 700 yards of the German lines. Scholz's corps was entrenched between the villages of Orlau and Frankenau. The Russians were under orders to take the trenches at all costs. They lay all night in position and crept forward another 100 yards before dawn. When the signal for attack came, they took the last 600 yards in 3 rushes, throwing themselves to the ground under the fire of the German machine guns, surging forward again and down and up again. As the wave of white-bloused figures with their glistening bayonets closed in, the Germans scrambled from the trenches, abandoned their machine guns, and fled. Elsewhere along the line, German superiority in artillery punished the attackers. The Russian 13th Corps on Martos's right, owing to a blunder in communications or poor generalship or both, failed to come to his support, and no great advantage was gained from the engagement. By the end of the day, the Germans were in retreat but not routed. The Russians captured 2 field guns and some prisoners, but their own losses were high, a total of 4,000. One regiment lost 9 out of 16 company commanders. One company lost 120 out of 190 men and all its officers. Though German losses were less, Scholz, facing overwhelming numbers, withdrew for some 10 miles, establishing his headquarters for the night in the village of Tannenberg. Still harried by Jelinski, who insisted that he must move on to the agreed line where he could cut off the enemy's retreat, Samsonov issued orders to all his troops, the 23rd on the left, the 15th and 13th in the centre, the 6th on the right, giving their dispositions and lines of march for the following day. Beyond Niedernberg, communications had become ever more feeble. One corps had run out of wire altogether and was relying on mounted orderlies. The 6th Corps did not possess the key to the cipher used by the 13th. Consequently, Samsonov's orders were issued by wireless in clear. Up to this moment, some 24 hours since the arrival of Ludendorff and Hindenburg, the 8th Army had not yet decided whether to bring down Mackensen's and von Below's corps to oppose Samsonov's right wing. Hindenburg and his staff came down to Tannenberg to consult Scholz, who was grave but confident. They returned to headquarters. That evening, Hoffmann wrote later, was the most difficult of the whole battle. While the staff was debating, a signal corps officer brought in an intercept of Samsonov's orders for the next day, August 25. Although this assistance from the enemy did not reveal Rennenkampf's intentions, which were the crucial question, it did show the Germans where they might expect to meet Samsonov's forces. That helped. The 8th Army made up its mind to throw all its strength into battle against Samsonov. Orders went out to Mackensen and von Below to turn their backs on Rennenkampf and march south at once. Chapter 16. Tannenberg. Haunted by the knowledge of Rennenkampf at his rear, Ludendorff was in a hurry to come to grips with Samsonov. He gave orders for the first stage of the battle to begin on August 25. It was to be an attack on Usdau by General von François' 1st Corps, with intent to envelop Samsonov's left wing. François refused. His heavy artillery and some of his infantry were still detraining from the journey that had brought them the long way around from the Gumbinnen front and had not yet come up. To attack without full artillery support and a full supply of ammunition, he argued, would be to risk failure. If Samsonov's path of retreat were left open, he would escape the destruction planned for him. He was privately upheld by Hoffmann and by General Scholz of the 20th Corps, who, although he had been in battle against the Russians on the previous day, assured François over the field telephone that he could hold his ground without immediate support. Confronted by insubordination on the second day of his new command, Ludendorff, in a high temper, drove down by car to François' headquarters, bringing Hindenburg and Hoffmann with him. In reply to his insistence, François said, "If the order is given, of course I shall attack, but my troops will be obliged to fight with the bayonet." To show who was in command, Ludendorff brushed aside François' reasons and reissued his orders unchanged. Hindenburg said nothing during the interview, and when it was over, dutifully drove off with Ludendorff. Hoffmann, in another car, stopped at the railroad station at Montovo, the nearest place in telephone and telegraph communication with headquarters. Here, a signal corps officer handed him 2 intercepted Russian wireless messages, both sent in clear, one by Rennenkampf at 5:30 that morning and one by Samsonov at 6 a.m. Rennenkampf's orders, giving marching distances for the First Army, revealed that his objective line for the next day would not bring him far enough to threaten the German army from the rear. Samsonov's orders, following the previous day's battle against General Scholz, revealed that he had misinterpreted Scholz's backward wheel as full retreat and gave exact directions and times of movement for the pursuit of what he believed was a defeated foe. No such boon had been granted a commander since a Greek traitor guided the Persians around the pass at Thermopylae. The very completeness of the messages made Major General Grunert, Hoffmann's immediate superior, suspicious. As Hoffmann tells it, "He kept asking me anxiously over and over if we should believe them. Why shouldn't we? I myself believed every word of them on principle." Hoffman claimed to have personal knowledge of a private quarrel between Rennenkampf and Samsonov, dating from the Russo-Japanese War, in which he had been Germany's observer. He said that Samsonov's Siberian Cossacks, after a brave fight, had been obliged to yield the Yentai coal mines because Rennenkampf's cavalry division had remained inactive despite repeated orders, and that Samsonov had then knocked Rennenkampf down in a heated quarrel on the platform of the Mukden railway station. Obviously, he demonstrated triumphantly, Rennenkampf would be in no hurry to come to Samsonov's aid. As it was less a question of aiding Samsonov than of winning or losing the campaign, it is arguable whether Hoffman believed his own tale or only pretended to. He always remained fond of telling the story. Grasping the intercepted messages, he and Grunert hurried to their car, sped after Hindenburg and Ludendorff, and on overtaking them within a few miles, Hoffman ordered the chauffeur to draw level and handed over the messages while the cars were in motion. All came to a stop while the four officers studied the situation. It showed that the attack planned for next day, in which Mackensen's and Bellow's corps were to attack Samsonov's right wing, could proceed without interference from Rennenkampf. According to differing interpretations by the disputants, it either did or did not show that François could afford to postpone his attack until all his men and materiel were up. Unwilling to yield an inch of authority, Ludendorff, on returning to headquarters, reiterated his orders. At the same time, orders were given to carry out the general plan for double envelopment next day, August 26. On the German left, Mackensen's corps, supported by Bellows, was to attack Samsonov's extreme right wing, which had reached a position at Bischofsburg with cavalry at Sensburg in front of the lakes, where it could have joined fronts with Rennenkampf if he had been there. His absence left open the flank, which the Germans hoped to envelop. In the centre, Scholz's 20th Corps, now supported by a Landwehr division and General von Morgan's 3rd Reserve division, was to renew its battle of the day before. On the German right, François, as ordered, was to open the attack that would envelop Samsonov's left wing. All orders went out before midnight of August 25. Next morning, the opening day of general battle, Ludendorff was attacked by a fit of nerves when a reconnaissance aviator reported movements by Rennenkampf in his direction. Although Hindenburg felt assured that the Eighth Army need not have the least hesitation in leaving open only a screen against Rennenkampf, all Ludendorff's anxiety returned. Rennenkampf's formidable host hung like a threatening thundercloud to the northeast, he wrote. He need only have closed with us, and we should have been beaten. He began to feel the same fears that had assailed Prittwitz, and to hesitate whether to commit all his forces against Samsonov or to abandon the offensive against the Russian Second Army and turn back against the First. "The hero of Liège seems to have lost his nerve a little," happily recorded Hoffmann, who of all military writers is the most prodigal in attributing this weakness to his colleagues. Even Hindenburg acknowledges that grave doubts afflicted his companion, and at this moment, as he claims, it was he who stiffened his chief of staff. In his words, we overcame the inward crisis. A different crisis erupted when headquarters discovered that François, who was still waiting for his artillery, had not begun battle as ordered. Ludendorff imperatively demanded that the attack begin at noon. François replied that the preliminary ground which headquarters supposed had been taken that morning had not been gained, provoking an explosion and what Hoffman describes as a probably unfriendly reply from Ludendorff. Throughout the day, François managed to balk and procrastinate and wait for his own moment. Suddenly, an extraordinary telephone call all the way from OHL in Koblenz broke in upon the argument with François. Worried enough without trouble from Supreme Headquarters, Ludendorff picked up the receiver and ordered Hoffman to listen in on another receiver to what they want. To his astonishment, he heard Colonel Tuppen, Chief of Operations at OHL, propose to send him reinforcements of 3 corps and a cavalry division. Fresh from the Western Front, Ludendorff, who had worked on the mobilization plans and knew to the last decimal the required density of manpower to mile of offensive, could hardly believe what he heard. Schlieffen's plan depended on using every last man to strengthen the right wing. What could have persuaded OHL to weaken its line by 3 whole corps at the height of the offensive? Appalled, he told Tappan that the reinforcements were not positively needed in the east and would in any event arrive too late for the battle that was already beginning. Tappan said they could be spared. The origin of this crucial decision was the panic at OHL when the Russians launched their offensive 2 weeks after mobilization instead of the 6 weeks on which the German plan was predicated. The saving factor, as Tappan reported, was the great victory on the French frontiers, which aroused in OHL the belief that the decisive battle in the west had been fought and won. Under this impression, Moltke decided, on August 25, in spite of objections put to him, to send reinforcements to save East Prussia from the Russians. The woes of the refugees, the Junker estates left to marauding Cossacks, the tearful pleas of well-born ladies to the Kaiser Inn to save family lands and fortunes, were having their effect. In order to arouse feeling against the Russians, the German government had deliberately distributed the refugees in various cities and succeeded in frightening itself. The president of the East Prussian Bundesrat came to OHL to beg for aid to his homeland. A director of Krupps wrote in his diary on August 25, "People said on all sides, 'Bah, the Russians will never come to the end of their mobilization. We can remain on the defensive for a long time.' But today everyone thinks quite differently, and the talk is all of abandoning East Prussia." The Kaiser was deeply affected. Moltke himself had always worried about the light defense in the east, for as he wrote before the war, "all the success on the Western Front will be unavailing if the Russians arrive in Berlin." Two of the corps he now withdrew from the Western Front had been in the fighting for Namur at the junction between the German 2nd and 3rd armies, and now, upon the fall of the Belgian fortress, were declared disposable by General von Bülow. With the 8th Cavalry Division, they were detached on August 26 and marched, because of the destruction of Belgian railroads, to stations in Germany for transport as quickly as possible to the Eastern Front. Another corps had got as far as the railroad station in Thionville when cautionary voices at OHL persuaded Moltke to cancel its orders. 800 miles to the east, General Samsonov was preparing for a renewed battle on August 26. On his extreme right, his 6th Corps, under General Blagoveshchensky, had duly reached the planned rendezvous area in front of the lakes. But Samsonov had left this corps isolated and detached, while he pushed the main body of his army in a more westerly direction. Although this drew it away from Rennenkampf, or from the place where Rennenkampf was supposed to be, it was the right direction, Samsonov thought, to bring him between the Vistula and the Germans, supposedly retreating to the west. Samsonov's objective was the line Allenstein-Osterode, where he could get astride the main German railway, and from where, as he informed Jelinski on August 23, it would be easier to advance into the heart of Germany. It was already apparent that his exhausted and semi-starved troops, who had barely managed to stumble to the frontier, were hardly fit for battle, much less for the heart of Germany. Rations were not coming up, the soldiers had eaten up their reserve rations, villages were deserted, hay and oats in the fields were not yet cut, and little could be scraped off the land for men or horses. All the corps commanders were calling for a halt. A general staff officer reported to Jelinski's headquarters the miserable provisioning of the troops. "I don't know how the men bear it any longer. It is essential to organize a proper requisitioning service." At Volkovysk, 180 miles east of the battlefront, as the crow flies, and even farther by roundabout railway connections, Jelinski was too remote to be disturbed by these reports. He insisted upon Samsonov continuing the offensive to meet the enemy retreating in front of General Rennenkampf and cut off his retreat to the Vistula. This version of what the enemy was doing was based on Rennenkampf's reports, and as Rennenkampf had kept no contact with the Germans after the Battle of Gumbinnen, his reports of their movements were an amiable fantasy. By now, however, Samsonov realized, from evidence of railroad movements and other bits of intelligence, that he was facing not an army in full retreat, but an army which had reorganized and was advancing toward him. Reports of the concentration of a new enemy force, this was François' corps, opposite his left flank were coming in. Recognizing the danger to his left, he sent an officer to urge upon Jelinski the necessity of shifting his army westward instead of continuing north. With a rear commander's contempt for a front commander's caution, Jelinski took this to be a desire to go on the defensive, and rudely replied to the officer, "To see the enemy where he does not exist is cowardice. I will not allow General Samsonov to play the coward. I insist that he continue the offensive." His strategy, according to a colleague, seemed designed for podavki, a Russian form of checkers, in which the object is to lose all one's men. On the night of August 25, at the same time as Ludendorff was issuing his orders, Samsonov disposed his forces. In the centre, the 15th and 12th Corps, under General Matos and General Kluev, with one division of the 23rd Corps under General Kondratovich, were to carry the main advance to the line Allenstein-Osterode. The army's left flank was to be held by General Artomonov's 1st Corps, supported by the other division of the 23rd Corps. 50 miles away, the isolated 6th Corps held the right flank. The reconnaissance techniques of Russian cavalry being less than competent, Samsonov did not know that Mackensen's corps, last seen streaming in panic from the field of Gumbinnen, had reorganized and in forced marches, together with Bellow's corps, had reached his front and was now advancing upon his right. At first he ordered the 6th Corps to hold its position with the object of protecting the right flank of the army, and then changed his mind and told them to come down with all speed to support the advance of the centre upon Allenstein. At the last minute, on the morning of the 26th, the order was changed to the original duty of remaining in position to protect the right flank. By that time, the 6th Corps was already on the march toward the centre. Far to the rear, a sense of disaster pervaded the Russian high command. As early as August 24, Sukhomlinov, the war minister, who had not bothered to build arms factories because he did not believe in firepower, wrote General Yanushkevich, the beardless chief of staff, "In God's name, issue orders for gathering up the rifles. We have sent 150,000 to the Serbs. Our reserves are nearly used up, and factory production is feeble." Despite the fervour of such gallant officers as the general who cantered to war shouting William to St. Helena, the mood of the army chiefs from the beginning was one of gloom. They entered the war without confidence and remained in it without faith. Gossip of the pessimism at headquarters reached the inevitable ear of the French ambassador in St. Petersburg. On August 26, he was told by Sazonov that Jelinski considers that an offensive in East Prussia is doomed to defeat. Yanushkevich was said to agree and to be protesting strongly against the offensive. General Danilov, deputy chief of the staff, was insisting, however, that Russia could not disappoint France and would have to attack despite indubitable risks. Danilov was stationed with the Grand Duke at Stavka, the general staff headquarters at Baranovichi. A quiet place in the woods where Stavka was to remain for a year, Baranovichi was chosen because it was the junction of a north-south railway line with the main line between Moscow and Warsaw. Both fronts, the German and Austrian, were superintended from here. The Grand Duke, with his personal suite, the chief officers of the general staff, and the Allied military attachés, lived and ate in the railroad cars, because it was discovered that the house intended for the commander-in-chief was too far from the station master's house used by the operations and intelligence staffs. Roofs were built over the cars to protect them from sun and rain, wooden sidewalks were laid out, and a marquee was erected in the station garden, where meals were taken in summer. Pomp was absent, and physical shortcomings ignored, except for the low doorways, against which the Grand Duke had an unfortunate tendency to bump his head. Fringes of white paper had to be fixed over all entrances to catch the Grand Duke's eye and remind him to duck. Danilov was disquieted by Rennenkampf's obvious loss of contact with the enemy and by failing communications, as a result of which Jelinski appeared not to know where the armies were, nor the armies each other. When news reached Stavka that Samsonov had engaged the enemy on August 24 to 25 and was about to renew the battle, anxiety about Rennenkampf's failure to bring up the other arm of the pincers became acute. On August 26, the Grand Duke visited Jelinski's headquarters at Volkovysk to insist upon Rennenkampf being urged forward. In his leisurely pursuit, begun on August 23, Rennenkampf had passed through the former German positions on the Angerup, which the Eighth Army had abandoned in its great transfer to the south. Evidences of hurried departure confirmed his picture of a beaten enemy. According to the notes of one of his staff officers, he believed it would be a mistake to push the Germans too rapidly. They might then fall back to the Vistula before they could be cut off by Samsonov. Rennenkampf made no effort to follow closely enough to confirm conjecture by eyesight, nor did this omission appear to worry Jelinski, who accepted Rennenkampf's version without question. The orders Jelinski issued to Rennenkampf on the day after the Grand Duke's visit were to pursue an enemy he still assumed to be retreating and to guard against a possible German sortie from the fortress of Königsberg upon his flank. It had been intended to mask Königsberg with 6 reserve divisions, but these had not yet come up. Now Jelinski instructed Rennenkampf to block Königsberg with 2 corps until the reserve divisions arrived, and with his other 2 corps to pursue those enemy troops which did not take refuge in Königsberg and may be supposed to be retreating to the Vistula. Supposing the enemy to be retreating, he did not conceive of him threatening Samsonov and did not urge Rennenkampf to hurry to close the junction with Samsonov's right wing as originally planned. He merely told him that the combined operations of the 1st and 2nd armies must aim at pressing the retreating Germans toward the sea and away from the Vistula. As the 2 Russian armies were neither in contact nor moving toward each other, the word combined was hardly applicable. When morning broke on August 26, Samsonov's 6th Corps began its march toward the center, in obedience to orders it did not know had been cancelled. One division was underway when the other division received news that enemy forces had been sighted some 6 miles behind it to the north. Assuming these were troops retreating from Rennenkampf, the Russian divisional commander decided to turn around and attack them. The force was in fact Mackensen's corps, itself moving forward to attack. It fell upon the Russians, and while they were fighting to save themselves, their fellow division, which had already marched 8 miles, was desperately summoned. It marched back again, and after covering 19 miles came up at the end of the day against a 2nd enemy corps, Bellows. Contact between the 2 Russian divisions was lost. The corps commander, General Blagoveschensky, lost his head. In this case, the formula is applied by a British military critic. The divisional commander, whose group had been in battle all day, suffering 5,000 casualties and the loss of 16 field guns, ordered retreat on his own initiative. During the night, orders and counter-orders added to the confusion, units became mixed up on the roads, and by morning the 6th Corps was in a disorganized shambles and continuing to fall back. Samsonov's right wing had been turned. While this was happening, his center of 2.5 corps took the offensive. General Martos was in the middle, heavily engaged. His neighbor on the left, a division of the 23rd Corps, was repulsed and thrown back, exposing his flank. On his right, General Kluev's 13th Corps took Allenstein, but learning that Martos was in trouble, moved to his support, leaving Allenstein to be occupied by the 6th Corps, which Kluev supposed to be on its way. The 6th, of course, never came, and a gap was left at Allenstein. A few miles behind the front, at 2nd Army headquarters in Niedernburg, General Samsonov was at dinner with his chief of staff, General Potovsky, and the British military attaché, Major Knox, when the beaten division of the 23rd Corps poured into the streets. In a mood of fear, any sound made them think themselves pursued. An ambulance wagon, clattering up, raised cries of, "Uhlans coming!" Hearing the commotion, Samsonov and Potovsky, a nervous individual who wore pince-nez and was known for some now obscure reason as the Mad Mullah, buckled on their swords and hurried out. They saw at first hand the condition of the troops. The men were terribly exhausted. They'd been 3 days without bread or sugar. "For 2 days, my men received no rations and none of the supplies came up," one regimental commander told them. Although he had not yet received full news of the disaster to the 6th Corps on the right, Samsonov realized by the end of the day that it was no longer a question of enveloping the enemy, but of saving himself from envelopment. He nevertheless decided not to break off battle, but to renew it next day with his center corps, in an effort to hold the Germans until Rennenkampf should come up to deal them the decisive blow. He sent orders to General Artemonov, commander of the 1st Corps, holding the front opposite François on the Russians' extreme left, to protect the flank of the army at all costs. He felt sure that not even a greatly superior enemy can break the resistance of the famous 1st Corps, and added that success of the battle depended on their holding firm. Next morning, the 27th, the impatiently awaited moment for François' offensive had come. His artillery had arrived,